Hello, this is your host Narine, and welcome to The Startup Way, a podcast where we unveil stories behind the scenes of startups' glorious success and drastic failure, spark thought-provoking conversations with investors, and engage leading experts to reveal what the future of technology beholds. The podcast series are powered by Triple S Ventures Venture Capital Firm, here to help you start, scale, and succeed in the startup world. Hi, today I have the pleasure of hosting David Bunyatyan, the founder and CEO of Active Loop. David, it's a pleasure to have you on our podcast. Could you please start by telling us a little bit about yourself and what does your startup Active Loop do?
Thanks for having me, Narine. Great to be here. Sure, I'm founder of Active Loop, so we are building a database for AI.
And what is the main problem that you're solving with Active Loop?
So I think the challenge that we have seen is that a lot of companies struggle with maintaining their data storage and connecting to AI models. Especially what happened last year is because of GPT-4 and OpenAI, the whole new generation of large language models got into production and into the hands of consumers. And then companies started to realize is that they have to take care of all the data that's been generating from the LLMs and also from the users, and then how to actually improve continuously those models so they can build better products, better AI, etc. And then the data challenge is one of the key pillars for having good AI models.
David, what you're doing now is a pivoted version of what Active Loop original did, correct?
So the iterations is that we did many iterations on which problem to focus on when we started. So maybe I can give a brief background. Before that, I was doing a PhD at Princeton University, was in a neuroscience lab, and we were dealing with really large amount of data. There's like a petabyte scale, which is 1,000 times the amount of the data that you can store on your notebook. And the challenge that we had is that processing this data on the cloud was costing us $1 million. And our goal was to reduce the cost by 5 times by rethinking how the data should be stored, how it should be streamed from the storage to the computing machine, should be used CPUs, GPUs, and what kind of models to use. And when we initially started, it was late 2017, early 2018, and that's where the transformers, which is one of the key pillars of the current large language models, the innovation that happened then, we realized is one of the bottlenecks of this is going to be the compute. How we can run this computation very, very efficiently, because both training those models and also running the data is going to cost us like millions of dollars. And like today, GPT-4 is rumored to be trained more than, just a single training was costing more than $200 million. And then when we initially started, the idea was like, how can we take this computation and distribute across multiple machines?
So your original idea was based on your PhD research. At what moment exactly and how did you come to the decision to utilize the insights gained during your research in an entrepreneurial venture?
So when I was actually at UCL, I was like, hey, we should start a company. I had many, many ideas in computer vision, in AI, and like one of the key, like initial things that we did at a hackathon in London was Tinder for news. So basically you can swipe right and left all the news that you receive, and then there's a machine learning algorithm that's learning from your user preference and then can feed more data that you're interested in. That got featured on TechCrunch, we got a lot of attention. But then quickly realized that that project is not flying. So I was like, okay, I'm gonna get back to my studies. And when I got into PhD post UCL status, I actually decided myself, I'm gonna focus on the research. So I was like, stopping the startups, entrepreneurships, etc. Let me just double down on something and try to become best. And that's, things didn't fly too long. So after 2 years, accidentally or incidentally, got back into startups.
You were enrolled in the 2018 YC Summer Batch, right? And YC is arguably the best accelerator program for startups. It can really define the startup's course of development in the early stages and set it up for success. There's a funny story about how you got accepted that you previously shared in other interviews, but I would appreciate you telling it for our audience as well.
Sure, definitely happy to. So basically, when I was at UCL, I applied to YC 3 times and never heard any feedback, any response. I mean, I got rejected, obviously. So at that time, when we were at Princeton, it's like, oh yeah, let's just try application on the last day and then like just spend an hour. Anyway, we knew that nothing was going to happen out and we just tried out. And then usually they invite you to Mountain View to go an in-person interview that happened before COVID. So, and unfortunately, I remember it was like April 25th or around those days, we got a special guest at Princeton from Google, Jeff Dean, who is their chief research scientist, coming to Princeton to have a meeting with a few grad students and talk about AI. And then that exact same day, we got the invite to YC, so I had to choose again, like, hey, should I go and meet Jeff Dean or go to the interview? Obviously, going to YC and meet the interview stage. So what happened there is that they actually brought our competitor there as well. And our competitor was way more advanced than us, meaning that they already launched their product. They put in Hacker News. They were top on the Hacker News, got a lot of users. And then they do something they didn't do usually. It's like they were interviewing us and then iterating like a couple times. So we were seeing them, it's like getting in, they were getting out. So we got actually friends with them. And we even agreed that if any of us receive an email, we should let each other know that we got rejected. So usually in YC, you get accepted if they give you a call on the same day, and then they send an email after 15 minutes. So for us, it was like 3 or 4 rounds of interviews. And the last question they asked, and I told this as well, is like, hey, what you guys figured out that nobody else figured out? And then we were 3 co-founders, me and Sergey. It's like we got surprised at that moment because we have prepared all the different answers to this question that we thought that the partners will ask, but we haven't thought about this one. And typically when you prepare to YC application, you'd like kind of try to isolate who is responsible for which question. And this question we hadn't even thought of to answer. And then surprisingly, Jason, our third co-founder, he got up and said, hey, we figured out how to run neural networks and crypto mining computation at the same time on the GPU way more faster than you can run it interleaving each other. And we're like, we got surprised. The partners also got surprised. And then they asked, okay, show us the benchmarks. And obviously we didn't have benchmarks because we didn't do this before. So we had to take an Uber, quickly go back to our Airbnb. And we were like, Jason, why did you say this? This is not fine, like lying in an interview, like, come on. And then he's like, no, guys, don't worry, I'll figure this out. And he started coding, like he actually, I think an hour later, he showed us the benchmark that was true. And at the same time that he showed us the benchmarks, we got the email. So me thinking, okay, great job, didn't work out, we have to fly back. And apparently, when we opened the email, is that there was written that, hey, like, you got, we can't reach you out, just call us back. So we got out, I called back, the first thing I said is like, hey, we got the benchmarks. They're like, you are in. I'm like, what about the benchmarks? They're like, nobody cares about the benchmarks. And then at that time, Sergey like just literally climbed the tree till the end. So we got super excited. And I think the moral there is that what YC was looking into is like, can actually these 3 tech-focused people figure out something that nobody else can figure out? And then the other competitor, they rejected at that time. They didn't email us, so they didn't ping us at all. But then they got accepted like 6 months later in as well. So I think that what YC was looking into is like, hey, can we bet on these people, not on the tech or the product? Because they knew that our product in the beginning is not going to work out.
I think that's their approach in general. They do always bet on the people rather than the idea, right? And what about your competitors? Where are they now? Are they still working on the same challenge?
They pivoted multiple times.
Okay.
Actually, one of the co-founders of the company, we got friends with them, so like the next 3 or 4 years, they started another Gen AI company that worked out pretty well. Learnings from it.
Eventually, it worked out for both of you.
Yes.
And can you share your main learnings and takeaways from the YC program? What is it that you expected? Was it what you expected it to be before enrolling?
So I think we were like, hey, we were treating this as an internship over the summer.
Uh-huh.
And we're like, we thought we're going to go back to our PhDs. Because then we took, there's like a lot of issues that you have to take care of. Like getting permission to do us, because it's kind of a leave to go there over the summer, work on your company, etc. So that was an interesting experience where like, you get a YC partners, like telling ruthlessly, hey, you're doing this wrong. You have to go and talk to your users. You have to launch as soon as possible. They told us so many times. We actually launched the first in our batch. And there was like 2 days after, although Brex was not a part of our batch, they were like a year ago, they launched as well and then like took over the whole field in banks, etc. But like I think launching as soon as possible was one of the key things. And then 2 weeks later, the product idea that we started with, actually, we wrote the blog post based on the key insight that Jason came up with during the interview, that blog post went mini viral. We launched a product on that, and then we got a lot of so many users that we had no any GPU available for them. Even the we were like restricting only for AI data scientists to use the platform to train the models. The costs were so cheap that the crypto mining people were hacking in and then trying to mine crypto using those servers. And we like during the night we were blocking them and not letting them to get in. We wrote even algorithms to find if the computation itself is a crypto mining and then kill them out.
Interesting. So talking accelerators, during one of our other podcast episodes, guest Marvin Lau, who is a partner at the San Francisco-based Diaspora Ventures and also an ex-partner at 500 Global, made a point that during the last couple of years, especially after COVID, most of the accelerators have become obsolete, especially for the founders based in San Francisco area. Because, you know, in San Francisco, there is enough of a community of experienced founders, like mastermind groups of super smart founders that you can learn from. Would you agree with that point?
That's actually a fair point. I have a lot of friends who's like, hey, why do I need to do YC? I can easily go and raise a couple millions of dollars from investors, like seed money. I also have friends who like just with closed eyes closed like 15 million on their seed round. So, and then people ask, how, why do I pay like 7% for getting, I don't know, 200K plus 300K or like 150K plus 350K total with mini valuation. I think for us, it was like really life-changing because we were like from New Jersey. We hadn't known any connections in Silicon Valley. We also were too much tech. We haven't thought about, okay, what does it mean to build a company? So YC, at least like giving you the initial grounding to land into Silicon Valley, was tremendously helpful. So the argument there is like, hey, I want to start a startup. I don't know what to do. Like, while other accelerators, I have been, I think when I was in London, I was at a Techstars, like one of them, I was doing some volunteering there just to learn about the startups, etc., or for their demo day, and it's like a totally different experience. And then why is it like dramatically different than other accelerators there? So, and then I do know second time both successful and not successful founders, by success I mean they exited or made the company public, they got back into YC and started another company as well. If you look from that perspective, I know like very few people know, but like OpenAI also was a YC startup. I mean, they were non-profit, so they were on a different track, but they started from there as well. I also know like the founder of Mixpanel, who built a unicorn, started a new company, got into YC, first even iteration didn't work out, and then switched to another company and is working out as well. But he chose to do it again. And then there's also Solomon Hikes, the creator of Docker. He also like, again, started, he became a partner technically, back, went back to YC, but then YC gives also this repetitive usefulness. It's like, because when you go and build a company, especially successful, you have to de-learn the initial strategies that you apply when you build a company so that you can go and scale. And then once you start a new company, you think about the scale perspective, but what YC is telling you is like, do things that don't scale from the beginning. So you have to unlearn all the unnecessary stuff that were useful for your late stage company to start a new one. So that from that perspective is also pretty useful. But again, it's like, it really depends on you, what you're looking for. If you ask me, like, regardless, I think I'll apply back again to YC and then start another company post this one.
And how did you decide to settle Silicon Valley? Was it after you went through the YC program?
Yeah, so I think I was living in New Jersey for 2 years. I mean, I was in London for three years, and then New Jersey for 2 years. Princeton, I think, is super nice. It's like an isolated campus-like environment where you can really focus on the research, mm-hmm. but also at the same time, it's super far from the startups, et cetera. So then when I moved to Silicon Valley through that period of building startups, obviously I've like watched the social networks, I've read so many books about building startups in YC. I met the people I've ever dreamed to work with or to collaborate. One of them, like the first book I ever read about startups was given by a friend, Martin, from London. He's now like, I think their CFO at Farfetch, etc. He's like, hey, here's the Lean Startup book, go and read this. And that really inspired me to go through this road. And then eventually have been connected to Eric and then also co-work together as well. So that's the amount of, I think the social network inside Silicon Valley is like super fast. Like people reply instantly, they network up very quickly, the introductions can go very bizarre. And then you also have this very ambitious, talented people concentrated in a very small location that a lot of technological waves came out of from there. And while during COVID, everyone's like, oh, we are moving to Florida, we're moving to Texas. I also like at some point moved to Hawaii as well. But then the point is that like now everyone is back, and because they realize they're missing out, like this FOMO is everywhere. It's like because the AI wave is a totally different one compared to the dot-com era or mobile application era.
Okay, so you would definitely recommend founders contemplating moving to Silicon Valley to do so?
Totally. I think from the professional perspective, like for me personally,
yeah,
there's a lot of trade-off I pay, right? Like social life,
yeah,
in Armenia is like perfect. It's like everyone's happy, you have family, you have friends.
Yeah.
Everyone is like going to bars over the nights. Like I was walking on Monday, 1 a.m. It was more active than Friday evening in San Francisco.
Yeah, I have never seen this phenomenon anywhere else. Like regardless of what day of the week it is, all the bars and restaurants are full in Yerevan.
Yes, it's like San Francisco is like only Friday.
Right.
That's it. So you have to book.
Yeah.
Here, like you have to start booking again. I think that that's the trade-off you pay, and everyone makes their own decisions. I have many friends who's like, hey, no, actually, life doesn't worth for me to do that. Like they also got into YCL and a few other top universities as well. But like, no, I want to stay here and build my life surrounding here. But then you decide what do you want to sacrifice and what do you want to gain. So, and then for building companies and startups, fortunately or unfortunately, Silicon Valley is still the epicenter, and a lot of things are happening from there.
It's a place to be. So you mentioned when you started out ActiveLoop, you had two other co-founders who decided to leave the startup in order to pursue their PhD degree. How did you make the decision in favor of staying and being a solo founder? And did the departure of co-founders impact you personally and professionally? Because it's a significant change in the life of a startup.
Totally. I think that that was likely one of my toughest points in life, aside from building the company itself, because we had raised a lot of money in 2018, about 1.8 million, and we had most of it in the bank, and we had also these investors. It's like, hey, like, keep pushing. But I think since my co-founders decided to leave, like, a decision was like, hey, let me offer everyone to take their money back if they want to. So we also had another funny story there as well, which I haven't shared with anyone. Paul Graham was one of our first investors,
yeah,
in the company. And we were like, hey, well, like, what should we do? Like Jason is leaving, like, should we continue or not continue? And I was like, in this super troubled times. And he even said like, hey, like, I think you should shut down and just start a new one. But then with Jason, was like, I think it was the fairest and correct one is like to offer everyone, if they want to take back, great. This like makes clear on my co-founder's page. It also helps me to reset expectations. So half of the investors left and half of the investors stayed in. And I was like, okay, great. Because I sent an email saying, hey, look, you have 30 days. You make a decision now. We will pay you back the investment that you did, like the portion that is unused now, like within 30 days. You don't reply, I'm continuing to do this. So I was like waiting to see who will stay, who will not stay, and that like 30 days was like, okay, what's going on? And half of them stayed, half of them left, so I had enough money to like, okay, decide what I'm gonna do. And apparently, PG is like, he didn't take my money back. He's like, great, he's like trusting me, he's like supporting, I'm gonna continue. Because one of the reasons he invested as well is like, we felt he actually saw that we are in trouble and he tried to help us, aside instead of like thinking, oh, we're gonna do great. So then I had that left money. I came back to Armenia, actually got a few team members here. That time was one, by the way, one book that another friend also recommended, Humbertson. He's like, hey, read this Principles book by Ray Dalio. That period of time was super, super helpful, especially like seeing how people went through tough times and then build the principles from there on. And then same as well, talk to Arthur as well, Johnny Baker, and it's like, hey, no, just keep pushing. So I think that's, and then the support that I got from my family, my friends, was like super massive. So it helped me to survive, let's say. And then I asked this question, is like, what do I want to do? And one of the passions I had at Princeton is like, hey, building this data infrastructure. We had this petabyte scale data. We didn't know how to properly store it. We came up with a so small package like called Cloud Volume. This is by William and Ignacio. that went viral inside our research lab, literally. And it was specialized only for solving for four-dimensional data to process neuroscience data. The idea is like, why don't I go and take this and then expand to all the data modalities, not only four-dimensional data, but also like videos, images, audio, text, and then build a data lake specialized for deep learning applications, because you have all these awesome databases, data warehouses, data lakes, lake houses, specialized for analytical workloads, but you don't have one for deep learning and AI at that time. There was no GenAI at that time, 3-4 years ago, but we basically started building a database for AI before it was cool. So we put it open source. It has been number 2 trending across all GitHub repositories, number 1 in Python languages. We built a community of 1,800 data scientists and data engineers. And now coming back to the point, it's like, hey, and then I had always this kind of backup plan. It's like, if things don't work out, I can go back and continue my PhD at Princeton. And I received this email, literally 2 words from my advisor, any decision. And then I was like, okay, I opened that email. I click on the forward. Did I see the graduate school pinging the computer science department? Hey, am I coming or not back to there or not? And they're like, play ping pong until one of them is like, hey, let us ping their advisor. And my advisor was also on sabbatical. He was at Samsung at the time. He's like, guys, just ask him. He's like, why do you ping me? And then Sebastian wrote me as well. He's like, hey, are you back, going back or not? And I said, like, this is one of my regretful decisions in my life, because likely I'm going to drop. And the reason why is that I think I can have much bigger impact on computer science itself by building this data infrastructure than doing my PhD. And if you ask me, it's like, why do I think like that? Is that because even in 2018, it was super clear that AI is going to be super huge. Now it's even much more clear, but it was like before even ChatGPT and the LLMs were there, etc. So the way I thought is like, hey, 10 years or 15 years later, if AI is big, what else is going to be big? And like, data is one of the key pillars for this to be supporting for AI to be there. Or another way is like, hey, if you want to control AI, just control the data itself. So that's what motivated me to focus on building the data storage, and that provides me a lot of meaning as well moving forward. And then the rest is like just execution.
Can you share maybe other challenges you faced on your entrepreneurial journey? Was there maybe a point where the challenges you faced were so overwhelming that you thought it's going to be the end of Active Loop?
I think we had many of those. I mean, co-founder leave is like one of the top things that kill us, the company. Another thing is, I think like having a vision or where you're heading towards, like one of the early days, we got a lot of feedback from our investors, so you are iterating too many times. So there's like a big trade-off between exploitation and exploration. So then you have to, as a founder, especially in pre-seed or seed stage, you have to figure this out. But once you get some user information and traction, things get normalized. I think one of the another key things were like, hey, we got a lot of open source adoption, but we had no revenue. And one of the key insights that PG and others as well told me is like, hey, just like focus on growing the revenue. And like optimizing revenue is like hard if you're building a data infra company like Databricks, which is like $43 billion now, Snowflake, which is a public, the biggest tech IPO, they did raise their Series Bs before they had any proper useful revenue. So building a data deep tech company, especially data infra company, like in any field itself, it's like a delayed execution. You had to have a lot of investment before. Mm-hmm. But before that, you have to show our proof points to be there. And one of the key things that helped us to go now to revenue, which like we started like making, like closing the Fortune 500 companies, public companies, use our both open source and the paid version of DeepLake and ActiveLoop, etc., is one very basic naive key insight. It's like, make sure per week you can get 10 customer calls. That like that amount of the information helps you to remove the noise, focus on the key use cases and the pain points that customers have, and then delivering them. So if you can iterate that, get to that stage, then it becomes kind of a brainer to do that.
I think there's, for startups specifically, there's always a dilemma between scaling quickly and innovating, both of which are critical to a startup. How do you strike a balance?
Where do you see the conflict with innovation and scaling?
When you try to scale quickly, you very often concentrate on the processes and operations rather than, say, research and development.
So the way YC tells, like, do things that don't scale.
Mm-hmm.
So then you initially don't have to worry about scaling at all. Mm-hmm. You have to figure out, like, a product that solves a pain point for 5 to 10 people and make them really love your product. And another advice they give as well is like, hey, ship to the users as soon as possible. So what it doesn't mean is like you really reduce the innovation period and then focus on the iterations. And then the iterations actually drive your process. So both for the innovation and scaling. So your process is like, hey, how can I ship this as soon as possible to customers and then show them that maybe their usage is up, they are ready to pay, they want to use your product, they love your product, and then will they be disappointed if your product will not exist? So I take a different approach. I also got super excited about this. It's like, hey, I got this super cool theory. If you know machine learning, basically in machine learning, there's this algorithm called Bayesian processing, and there's also more gradient descent. And Bayesian processing is very similar to a startup where it's pre-product market fit. You have to run a lot of experiments. You try to dig holes in different places to find oil. And then once you get to a revenue stream, then you got a product market fit. I mean, depending on how you define it, then you switch to a gradient descent. And gradient descent is you just optimize with your target metrics, ideally with the revenue that your company is collecting for. So if you look from that perspective, both of them are innovation and scaling. Just like a pre-product market fit, you have to do a lot of innovation, plus PMF, you have to focus on scaling. However, that's not the end of the world. So if you read the book I read, it's like pretty good one, it's called Good to Great. And what it does, it went to many companies, both successful and failure, over the last 50 years, how they went to a stage where you are at a large organization and you have to like continue making more money, but then you are stalled. There's no any innovation, your company's going to go down. And then it discusses like what are the key things that you can take the company within that position and try to innovate. Because at every stage, you are like either harvesting or you're innovating, and you have to make a decision. Well, starting from who is your CEO and how you're going to run the process. For example, like Apple, for the last 10 years, 20 years, they were more or less not innovating. They were like harvesting all the iPhone iterations. And then Tim Cook himself is like a very good execution person who's like driving this harvesting period. However, because of that decision, now John Ive, who was the innovator within Apple, he left the company. So, and then you have to be very careful to do the switches correctly. Otherwise, only harvesting will not work out, and only innovation obviously will not work out as well. What it refers to us is like, it took us a lot of time to do the necessary innovations to come to a point where the product is ready that enterprise can use it. And because when we were starting, it's like, we didn't know how to build a database. We knew how the AI models work, but like building a database is a very tricky challenge, to the point where like we hired a lot of junior engineers who even don't, like they need to learn how to write a proper software. And the problem there is they don't have a lot of experience, but it's also actually a good thing. These people who don't have a lot of experience, they don't see the limits. I remember one time we hired a very senior database engineer, and he's like, hey, this is what we want to achieve. He looked at me straight with face. He's like, you are crazy. This is not possible to be doing. And exactly a year later, we published a paper at a top database conference where we showed this is working out. And he like left the company after a month. Like he pinged us back saying, oh, I'm surprised this was possible. So that helps with building a team who was like, has super ambitious but doesn't have experience of building such things.
So you mentioned also previously that with deep tech company, it requires quite a significant time to achieve some revenue. But for fundraising, you still need to show traction for your investors. Like at every stage, you need to show some traction to be able to fundraise a new round. Can you share some insights from your experience in fundraising and also maybe give any tips for successful fundraising?
So we got lucky with open source driving the adoption. Obviously, we got lucky first, we got into YC, and then closing the demo day in YC is like pretty, I would say, straightforward. But then afterwards, we had this doom period where you have to figure out a lot of things. And the traction is like one of the key pillars to be able to raise more funds. But you don't, I think like raising funds, it's like an addiction. You raise more, you spend more, you want to raise more. Yeah. And you have like really big companies raising hundreds of millions of dollars sitting on this addiction. And eventually you have to show profit, especially recently because the economics as well changed in the whole world. and like raising money became difficult. Like last year, there are like Series A's went down 25%. Before that, you had the Series B's and Series C's, so later stage fundraising is also very tricky. So you have to plan carefully, especially if you are deep tech within very challenging times.
Mm-hmm.
So having said that, there's also the other perspective if you're in infrastructure business. Like infrastructure business like survives during hard times because everyone starts caring about cutting down costs,
mm-hmm.
making sure that you build the roads, you can survive, etc. So on the other hand, then your importance of a product you're building becomes critical. So you have to be very careful on what kind of a product you're building. And then now, like going back, okay, what are the insights that can help you with fundraising? I think aside from having the proof points for either your technology, your product, your usage, and later proof points on like enterprises, if you're building a B2B company using your product, like OpenAI took how many, like from 2016 is like 7 or 8 years to building a model. They had zero clue in the beginning, will they eventually be a profitable or business company? I mean, it's still unclear if it's profitable or not, but they did one of the fastest revenue growth from almost zero to billions of revenue within a year. And they're now one of the biggest private companies there exist. So, but then don't take OpenAI as a North Star. They are an exception. And then usually what you have to do is like, if you can be profitable from day zero, that's the perfect business you can build. And then treat fundraising as like just helping you as like the lead scale to the next stage as fast as possible.
When talking about running AI models, you cannot talk about computer chips and GPUs. That's something you always refer to. And a major cost and limitation for running AI models is having enough chips to handle the computations. And obviously the chip manufacturing industry is currently dominated by a few manufacturers. And because there is a limited number of fabs capable of making high-end chips, you have to bid for capacity years before you need it in order to produce the new chips. And there has been a lot of new competition in the industry. For example, OpenAI CEO Sam Altman announced his efforts to raise billions for his AI chip venture. What do you think the market of manufacturing chips will look like in a few years from now? And what is your prediction on how and when will the chip shortage end?
It's a very good question.
Yeah.
I have many insights and stories that I've never shared. So I try to be as open as possible. So first of all, in 2017, when the Transformers paper got out in NeurIPS, the company's name was NIPS. It's like one of my friends, Pierre, who is building a company called iBuyAI, he's like my classmate and my close friend, who is building a generative AI music. So there was like NVIDIA launch, and then he was generating the music for that NVIDIA launch, and
mm-hmm.
Jensen was there as well, their CEO. So we went there, we actually took a picture with him, and that was like 2017. They already knew that the deep learning gonna be big, and the GPUs they have to like plan 4 years before to be able to hit the right mass. So then in 2018 summer, when we got into YC, one of my friends, Sophia, is like, hey, you should come to our party. I got a lot of friends you'll introduce. And then at that moment, we met Alex Krizhevsky. And Alex Krizhevsky actually is the cause of deep learning revolution. He came up with, in 2012, this model that's called AlexNet. He didn't name his own model.
Mm-hmm.
Usually in science, you don't name your own name, the models. So AlexNet was this key moment where you take a neural network,
uh-huh.
run it on a GPU, give a lot of data, like a million images, and then it could beat the state-of-the-art computer vision algorithms by more than 20%, showing a significant boost getting the state-of-the-art results. And it was only one time that happened, and the whole computer vision industry went nuts on using deep learning for computer vision use cases. Obviously, the deep learning research was there for the last 30 years, but then what you realize is there's like you first of all need a big data set that was ImageNet, million images. Then you need computation running on GPUs. And then you also need people, talent like Alex, at that time like Ilya Sutskever, who's the ex-chief research scientist of OpenAI, was also one of the co-authors, and then Jeff Hinton, who is the creator of or like one of the original founders of neural networks and being working on this research for a while. What you saw there in 2012, the algorithm got applied with CUDA, which is the library that you use behind the scenes, on the top of a GPU to be able to train those models. Now, let's go back a step. NVIDIA bet on CUDA like in 2008. That was one of their very exotic bets as a GPU making company, which they originally were just used for video games, like playing video games. I played so many video games on NVIDIA hardware, and nobody actually used the GPUs for high performance computing or for training AI models even more. So from there on, NVIDIA's game totally changed. So now they realized is that, hey, like we have these chips, they're super good for deep learning, but the chips are not enough. You have this middle layer, this CUDA library, that can actually make the neural networks run very, very efficiently on the GPUs. And then since then, what happened is that the GPU, like all the deep learning frameworks, start by natively use CUDA for running on top of the NVIDIA GPUs. And then the demand for that started growing. Obviously, in the middle, you had the crypto boom, which kind of messed up with the revenue stream. But if you look into the NVIDIA, like last 2 years of their revenue growth, is like huge. Like now NVIDIA is like a $1 trillion worth company, and everyone by default, like no way you can find GPUs anywhere. Like you have derivative companies who buy GPUs and lend them to others. Obviously you have the big clouds. You have also this companies like Lambda or CoreWeave. Mm-hmm. They raised money. They also even took a venture debt of $2 billion, putting the GPUs under the condition if they fail paying, that the GPUs will be, like, you can sell this and bring back the money. So the hardware chip industry went nuts. So when I was, I think, 2 years ago in New York, like one of the investors we met, like, that time was like, no, it's like, he asked me, do you know, like, do you want an advice where to put money? It's like, go and buy a lot of chips. This is gonna go like very rare. Obviously you have this more geopolitics as well with Taiwan, etc. And then US putting $50 billion on building fabs in Texas. And then Intel as well doubling down on building factories for building chips in US, like moving from Taiwan. And then there's also the other part of this whole transition, just to imagine the trend, is that you have this large language models doubling in size every, if I correctly remember this, every could be like about a year or less than a year in terms of number of parameters you need, so you need much bigger GPUs. And the Moore's law is like doubling the GPU capabilities like 1.8 years. And the Moore's law is dead. So you have the LLMs, like they're like running, becoming bigger and more useful, but the hardware, underlying hardware, is like kind of thought of to be stuck in future. Like I think there isn't more like 3 nanometer chips. They're getting into the GPUs and the CPUs as well. So that's where like the land is there. Now, also I remember in 2018, we met the head of Google TPUs. So he was one of the founding like early startups at YC in 2006. And then we got introduced to him, so we went to Google, so we met him. And it's like, he was like, at that time, it was not super clear that AI is gonna be big. And he convinced the Google to invest maybe order of hundreds of millions of dollars to building their own chips, which they call TPUs, to expect the demand. They did a very right move at that time, but like if you look at that position, in hindsight, it's a perfect move. At that point, like nobody really answered if this is the right bet or not. So I think the realization that you having more data, having more compute, and also the talent that uses this data to train LLMs, like has a huge impact on chips. And if you read this very interesting book, I'm in the middle of it, like called Chip Wars, it goes from the early days how the whole transistor industry has been created and how different companies have been spun out, including the HPs, the Intel, and then later it gets to AMD and NVIDIA as well. So I think there's so many learnings from there. And then the interesting thing with GPUs is that you have to plan 4 years before building the chips. Like the life cycle is like very, very long compared to shipping the software. And then on the other hand, Apple was like building, like using Intel CPUs for a while to ship their MacBooks. They started building their own chips. And they are perfect as well, because now you have this different architecture where you have the CPU and GPU all together within the same memory environment, etc. So I believe like the chip industry is also like shifting and up to the level that it might hit the geopolitics as well regarding the Taiwan situation. And then especially US putting bans on not selling any like small nanometer chips to China. And then like NVIDIA figuring out how to sell like billions of dollar worth GPUs to ByteDance or other like AliCloud, etc. So there's a lot happening in the chip industry.
Yeah.
And that has a huge impact on the whole AI space. And the biggest profit makers is today's NVIDIA.
Yeah, it's definitely going to shape geopolitics, economics in large. And a lot is happening there. So it's interesting to observe how the industry is changing. We also cannot skip the next question I'm going to ask you, since you're an Armenian founder. Where do you see the role of Armenia in the global AI ecosystem? And what is the correct way to position ourselves now? What do we have to offer in terms of resources, talent, knowledge, and expertise?
That's also a good question, actually. So we are in a very unique position that we have so many AI companies in Armenia, even before the AI was like a trendy topic at all. Like, including like PixArt, was like the Gen AI, the generative AI with this like Midjourneys and all the image generation, etc. Like PixArt is also one of the frontiers of this technology there. Then you have companies like Annotation, the infrastructure's perspective that helps you both training and building these models and also managing the data there as well. And you also have consumer app applications that helps use these AI models to ship to the consumers. So essentially, as an AI company, like AI country, you got all the different aspects of an AI setups within the same location, and it can drive big changes as well. So plus you got the AI researchers from the early days in like training and deploying these LLMs into the production. We have Armen Hochinen, who's like one of the founders at MIT-AI doing there. We have here Hrant Khachatryan, who's like built the Yerevan LLM like for years doing research, where even my friends at Princeton is like, they were surprised. Oh, they did this like various papers or the open source projects. So you have all these very significant people of Armenian descent, both located in the country and outside, have all the expertise. And now the challenge is like, how can you get the resources necessary to be able to leverage the LLMs, large language models or foundation models to build and create a lot of value that can put the country on an AI frontier.
And what are the resources you're referring to? Is it like, say, computing power?
Well, one of the key things is like we need more GPUs. We also got lucky, is like, unfortunately, because of the war, NVIDIA moved their whole office or headquarters to Armenia. So you, plus you have this like one of the giant biggest companies in the world having office in this location. So what's next is like, I think building the GPU data infrastructure for data centers. I heard recently that the country is going to buy like 64-800 GPUs, which is a good start.
Mm-hmm.
But today, like Meta AI launched, like they are buying 100,000 of GPUs.
I think 300,000 new GPUs,
yes.
Right?
it's an order of 20 billions of dollars of purchase, which is like difficult for our country. However, that's like could be one of the bets for us to take our and build a strong one. And then you need the data. So data, infrastructure, and the human resources. I think we have very talented people in the human resources. We need more GPUs, and we need to be able to collect the data. So these three things together will help us to build an AI frontier company, a country, together.
And what would be the most interesting AI project now in Armenia that you can mention? Maybe a startup or a company, not a huge name like PixArt that's considered Armenian, but something nascent, something that's just being formed.
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things, as well as doing research with one of the local universities here for the last few years, is that we were looking into how we can take the large language models
mm-hmm.
and building the so-called RAGs or retrieval augmented generation on top of Armenian documents. And then apparently our national academy of both the sciences and the library as well, they have so many manuscripts in Armenian. And I know there's a few projects as well, they're taking this data and then training the LLMs that can like think of this, it can just upload the whole history of Armenia and all the Armenian manuscripts into a model, language model. It's not just the Wikipedia pages. It's like, this is like a reasoning engine that then later you can leverage to solve certain use cases. So I think the first step is to collect all the data in Armenian and train or fine-tune those LLMs. The second one is like, okay, now we have this. Can we actually align with our interests and then put this into the use?
Okay. David, thank you for joining us today. It was wonderful to talk to you. Very insightful conversation.
Likewise, Anna, thanks for the invite. So very happy to be here.
Thank you.
To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to The Startup Way. We hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did. If you've caught the innovation bug, don't miss out on future episodes. Hit that subscribe button. Your feedback fuels our mission to decode the tech world. So leave a review, connect with us on social media, and keep the discussion going. Stay curious, stay inspired, and keep disrupting until our next digital rendezvous.